Hi, my name is Aral Balkan, and I'm the founder and lead designer of a small social enterprise in the UK called Indie. And we're building alternative technologies, independent technologies that don't spy on people.
In your speech, you said in one way we all become cyborgs, or maybe we are already cyborgs. That means we should draw the boundaries of the self in a different way. We have to draw the boundaries of ourselves in that sense that we have to include the technology. What does it mean exactly?
Well, it means that we have to alter the way that we look at technology. Technology is not something that's external to human beings. When I make a note on my mobile phone, for example, I'm extending myself. It's an extension of my brain. So if somebody reads that note, then they are violating myself. And that's how we have to start seeing it, because we already have laws that protect the self, the corporeal, our physical bodies. And we have to start to understand that those laws should apply to our digital selves, or as I call them, our simulations, our profiles.
What I saw is that you are looking for technical solutions, but now you talk about laws. Do we need new laws?
We need new laws, we need to be engaged politically, and we need technical solutions. Building technology by itself is not going to fix the problem that we have, because the core of our problem that we're facing is systemic inequality. And that's probably the core problem in the Anthropocene, in the human era that we're living in today. So to tackle that problem, it's a problem of inequality. To tackle it, we need technology, we need political involvement, and we need new legislation.
You said what we now have is dark design or dark technology. That sounds very dark. What is dark design?
Well, dark design is design that's not in the interests of individuals, of human beings, but more in the interests of the corporations that carry out the design. So in Silicon Valley, we have a model, a business model of selling people, not products. So something like Google, for example, a company like Google, they give you products that are very useful, but you're the user, you're not their customer. You're actually what they sell to their real customers. By using their products, you are telling them and revealing things about yourself, personal information. And that's what they sell to their actual customers. So this is dark design, because they have to make their products as addictive as possible. There's even a book on this called Hooked, how to design addictive experiences. It's terrible, right? It's like you're trying to get someone addicted to drugs, because the more you use their products, the more they learn about you, and so the more money they make from that information about you. That's what I would call dark design, and it's the dominant paradigm of design today in technology.
You even, in your speech, you even compared it with drug dealers.
Yes. I mean, there are only two professions in the world where we call the people who use our products users, right? One are drug dealers, and the other is technology.
I never thought about this. You also talked about a camera panopticon, that we live in a camera panopticon that is able to simulate each of us. Could you describe this?
Well, when you think about it, let's again take Google, because they're the biggest, most prominent example. Google knows so much about every one of us, because we use Gmail, we use Google Drive, and they're looking through all of the things that we do there. Every email we send, every file we put up, every photo we upload, right? You combine all of that information about us, about people, with all of the information they have about the world, through maps, through satellite images, through all of the information they get from tracking each one of us. And what do you get? You get a camera, a global camera, that's always recording everything about everyone and everything in the world. And that's what I call a camera panopticon. It's like the panopticons of old, where we had a prison with a single guard in the middle, and the guard could see everyone, but the prisoners could not see the guard, and could not even see if the guard was there. And the idea was that the prisoners would always behave well, because they knew that they were always being watched. Now we're creating a global panopticon, and it's through the products of companies like Google and Facebook, and of course, all of this information is also being shared by governments, with governments.
So what we need now is solutions, not only laws, but also technical solutions, both. You said, let's start with the technical solutions. You said that, for example, open source is not a solution. Why that?
So open source, and we shouldn't confuse open source with free software as well. Free software as in free as in freedom, right? These free software started 30 years ago with Richard Stallman, and I have the most respect for him and the movement he started. But it was started in a different era and in response to different challenges. So free and open source have contributed hugely to technology. The internet runs on open source technologies at the infrastructure level, but very few of us use free or open source technologies as end user products, right? Few of our phones are open source, right? Few of our computers actually use open source software. And that's what we need to change, but we can't change it if we can't compete on the experience. The reason people use Facebook, the reason we love Apple products is because they're beautiful, they're easy to use, and I don't mean aesthetically just, they're functional, they're convenient, they're delightful. And those of us who are trying to build solutions that protect human rights and democracy and protect the freedoms of individuals have to build solutions that are beautiful and convenient and easy to use, because we can't compete on ideology. We have to compete on experience. If we can't, no one's going to use the products that protect their freedoms and protect democracy.
And why is OpenAPI a con, as you said in your speech?
So OpenAPIs were a concept that really rose to prominence around Web 2.0. So Tim O'Reilly was one of the very vocal proponents of Web 2.0. And what it means is companies like Google and Facebook and Twitter saying, look, we're going to give you limited access to our infrastructure, to developers, and build products that use our services. So build a Twitter client, for example. We have an open API that lets you do that, and you're helping to build an open web. This was not true, because an open API is limited access to private property. You get a key to a lock that can be changed at any time because you don't own the lock. And that's how we were conned into building products that actually added value to these closed silos, Twitter, Facebook, Google, all the while thinking that we were helping build an open web, but we were actually contributing to the growth of these monopolies that are closed. And that's why it's a con.
So as a solution, you propose that we go beyond the cloud and beyond the web. And a decentralized web, that's not the solution, you said. Why that?
No, I mean, remember, the cloud is just a computer owned by someone else, not you. So we need to go beyond this. It's about ownership and control. Individuals have to have ownership and control of the technologies by which they experience and participate in modern life. So the way to do that is not through the web, because the web is part of the problem. The philosophy of the web and the architecture of the web are two very different things. So Tim Berners-Lee, when he thought about what he wanted the web to be, wanted it to be a free, open, universally accessible space. But when he designed it in a client-server architecture, which is decentralized, which means that there are still centers. And those centers, if there are economies of scale, and there are, they will scale vertically. They will become the monopolies that we see in Facebook and Google and in Twitter, for example. That is the nature of the web. It's not a bug. There's nothing wrong with the design of the web. It's acting as designed today. The monopolies are a natural aspect of it. We need to move beyond this to a distributed topology where every node is equal, where each one of us is a node, and we own our technologies, and we can communicate directly with one another with no centers, so that we can share a photo without also sharing it with Facebook.
So without mediators, yeah, like Facebook or Google or so?
Exactly, exactly.
But how would that work?
It just works exactly as I described it. There's no technical infeasibility here. The reason Facebook says to you to share a photo with your friend, you must share it with me, there's no technical reason for that. There's every business reason. That is how they make their money. So we can build a system where I can just share my photo directly with you, from my phone, for example, to your phone. And the biggest challenge there is to make that system as beautiful, as convenient as possible. And we can, because we actually have a user experience advantage over companies like Facebook and Google, because we're only designing for one audience, just the people who will use the things that we make, right? Google and Facebook have to design for two very different audiences, their customers, the people who pay them, and their users, and their needs are orthogonal. So they have a much harder job, actually, and we have an advantage only if we use it.
But okay, you can change your photo with me, but if you want to change your photo the same time with a lot of other people, what do you do then?
We can do that as well. So why do they have to go to Facebook to see your public photos when they could just go to your website, for example? And in the solution that we're building at Indy, that's exactly what we're doing. So it lets you, it's called Heartbeat, it lets you share your photos, for example, with the people that you know, your family, etc. But then if you want to make something public, that's great. It's also shown on our website if you want it to be. But you also have a copy of that running on your local server. You don't even have to know how to set it up. It just happens. But you can have a domain name that points to that, and people can go to your own website because that's what you're really building. So this is, and it's so cool because you're in control of that, right? It's your place on the web. It's your place on the internet. And it's private by default. And that's what privacy means. It's about having the choice to decide what you want to share and what you want to keep to yourself. And the default is, I'll keep it to myself, or okay, now I want to share this with my friends, with my family, or with everyone. But it's your decision. The problem with mainstream technology is you don't have the decision not to share with Facebook when you use Facebook. When you set something to private on Facebook, it's private for everyone else, right? But Facebook. Facebook always gets to see what you're doing.
But wouldn't you say that in the digital age, the concept of privacy has changed?
I think it's in the interests of some people for it to be portrayed that way. Yes. So Mark Zuckerberg says privacy is dead. But what he really means is privacy is dead for you, not for me, not for Mark Zuckerberg. Because when Mark Zuckerberg is renovating his house, he signs non-disclosure agreements with the people working for him so they can't even tell people that they're working for him. He buys the houses on either side of his house so that he can have privacy. So when people tell you privacy is dead, they mean privacy is dead for everyone but us. So it's really a power dynamic. The way privacy works, corporations and governments have more privacy maybe than they've ever had. It's individuals and individual humans who are supposed to think that privacy is dead. We're supposed to believe that our privacy is dead. It's not. We care about our privacy.
I think, or I assume that there are already technical solutions labeled with IndieWeb.
So the IndieWeb is separate to what we're doing. We're independent technology with Indie, and we are looking beyond the web. There are people who are trying to make things better on the web, and that's, of course, admirable. I think there are many stopgaps that are being created. But longer term, we need to move beyond the web. We need to move beyond the client service architecture, beyond the decentralized topology, to create a peer-to-peer distributed topology, both in technology and in society. So it's kind of like the difference between a factory farm and an organic farm. If you think about it, a factory farm is centralized and it's terrible for the welfare of the animals that are there, and it scales vertically and it's huge and it needs to keep growing to make a profit, right? Organic farms, they can't grow that way. They have to grow sustainably. They grow horizontally. And that's the model that we need to move beyond if we want a sustainable world.
So how will you implement it? You will build an extranet?
The way that we're doing it is we're building a peer-to-peer distributed network. But we're also building a bridge between that and the web, because we need to wean people off of the systems that exist today, and that has to be convenient. And there are advantages to the web, findability and availability. When you go to Facebook, you know all your friends are going to be there, and you know that Facebook's always going to be there. So we take those advantages and we use that to make it easy for people to find one another. But when we meet, so we go to Indy and we meet. And once we've met, all of our devices connect to one another, and Indy steps out of the way. It doesn't say, now, yes, I've introduced you, but I also want to listen to everything that you say. That's creepy. That's what Facebook says, right? Facebook is like the bartender at a bar that you go to meet friends, but then the bartender comes home with you. That's really creepy and wants to know everything you're doing. So the alternative is, let's use all of the advantages we have on the web for introducing people, but then let's let them have their privacy, right? So that's what we're building, that bridge between the web and a distributed peer-to-peer network.
So I can already use it?
It's in private pre-alpha right now. And hopefully, I mean, my goal is to be able to open it up, hopefully within this year. And once released, it will be released as free and open source, as well as hopefully available on the Apple App Store so that people can buy it if they want the convenience. But if they want to look at the code or install it themselves, they can just get it and download it and use it. And that's very important because it means that you don't have to trust us. You can verify it yourself. You can install it yourself if you want to. And the only systems that are worthy of trust are the ones you don't have to trust.
How can you reach a critical mass? I mean, that's the main question. Yeah?
Slowly. Organically. Remember, one of the core aspects of independent technology is that we don't take venture capital. We don't play the Silicon Valley game. That's not the only way of doing technology, making technology. So if you take venture capital, of course, you need to grow as quickly as you can and to finalize the sale you made at the very beginning, because that's when you sold your company and your future users, when you took the investment and you lost control. We don't have to do that. So we can start small. We can be sustainable. We will be charging for things like encrypted backups that are always available, that will bring recurring revenue. And we will be cash flow positive and sustainable going forward, and we'll grow organically. We don't need to have a meteoric rise and then a sale or an IPO. That's not the game we're playing. We want to build a sustainable future. So my criterion for success for this is whether or not I'm still working on it in 20 years' time or 30 years' time. If I have kids one day, it's whether or not they inherit this organization. We need to start thinking about success in much longer time frames.
Where do you get the money for that?
Well, initially, I sold a family apartment that we have. We're not rich, but it was a cooperative that my parents had paid into for 30 years, and I was meant to inherit it. But I don't need an apartment. I don't need a flat. I want to see this vision come to life. I want to live in a world where I'm not the product being sold. So we sold that, and that kept us going. We were bootstrapping. And then we went to crowdfunding at the end of last year. And we took donations. That was about the apartment brought in about £80,000, I think. So that's, of course, all gone. And the donations brought in about $100,000. And that's what's keeping us going right now. And hopefully we will quickly get to a point where we can sell the application and then services around it. So that's what's keeping us going right now. And we're, of course, looking for investment, but not venture capital. That was our core design decision when we set up the organization. We don't even have shares. We don't have equity. We're a special type of company in the United Kingdom called Limited by Guarantee. So we can't sell the company even if we wanted to. We can't sell shares or equity because we don't have it. And that was so important because I need to be able to guarantee that we can deliver on what we want to deliver. And that means we need full control. But we can take other types of investment, like maybe share of revenue. And we're definitely open to that. We want to build a sustainable business. And we want to prove that you don't have to be, you know, hugely evil like these Silicon Valley companies to be a successful business. And sustainability is very important.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.